What is up, everybody? My name is Chris Hall. Welcome back to Beyond Season 1, Episode 8. We got a great episode for you guys today. It's Caddy, my friend who I've known for about a year now. He was part of the first and biggest social media agency in the UK called Social Chain, now expanding into the US. This is a great origin story about a company that really started out of some scrappy kids, basically. I mean, literally, like, Caddy was running an Instagram page and met the founder, sold a page to the founder, and they became friends and colleagues, and they really built what has become the largest social media influencer agency in the UK, based out of the UK, and now they're just expanding over to the US. So if you're interested in social media influencers and how the new wave of media is really affecting the global advertising market, this is a great episode for you guys. He has a lot to learn from, and the origin story is just amazing. I was really happy to have Caddy on. I do want to thank quickly B&H, who's been sponsoring this since the first episode. I've been shopping at B&H for about 10 years. I was a filmmaker, I was a photographer, and now I'm doing a podcast and I'm an entrepreneur, but everyone needs gear. And I've been shopping with them for 10 years, and I'm so thankful that they have been sponsoring this podcast since the beginning. And I also want to thank Hint Water, who is also one of the OG sponsors in my life and career. They sponsor all of our events that I throw in New York City. Hint Water is just great alternative to soda for me. Like, I've just, you know, I drink it every day. I mean, to be honest, I drink 3 or 4 bottles a day, so it has to be good. And my guests enjoy it too. So thank you to Hint Water and B&H for sponsoring this. With that said, guys, let's get into this episode. All right, guys, welcome. Caddy, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
So we first met at the All Things Social Media Meetup.
Yes.
Right, which is a big Facebook group with a lot of, like, marketers and entrepreneurs in it. But kind of over time, we've kind of stayed in touch, and I found it, you know, really interesting what you're doing at Social Chain, and, you know, how you got involved in that from the very beginning, and now it's coming to the US, it started in the UK and all that. And obviously, like, influencer marketing, and marketing is, like, huge right now. You know, influencer and celebrity marketing is marketing, and viral marketing is marketing. I'm really interested in kind of, you know, bringing that kind of story of how that started to the listeners of the podcast. There's a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this. So kind of right now, what are you doing? What's your, like, position, and what are you working on right now? And then we can kind of get into the backstory of where you grew up and came to the US and everything like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad we were finally able to nail this down. I know it's taken a couple of weeks, but it's good to finally be
it's
here.
It's always like that.
I can imagine. So I currently serve as the creative director for Social Chain in the US, looking after the New York office. Moved here about a year and a half ago to set up the New York business, really kind of spent the first year building out what our product was, and now kind of serve as the creative lead for the agency. So managing all our creative output, all our creative for the clients, but also, you know, building out the team, a lot of recruitment, and driving the culture. So a lot of operations as well.
What is Social Chain for someone who's never heard?
Yeah, so Social Chain is, well, it's two things. It's a social first marketing agency. So we're an agency that manages the social presence and the digital presence for a lot of big clients, a lot of mainly consumer-based clients, fashion retailers. We do a lot of work with entertainment clients, a lot of sports clients, fitness as well. And as you know, any agency work we do, such as creative, we'll manage their Instagram, we'll manage their Facebook, build their audiences, do their paid marketing, just about everything from the top of the funnel to the bottom as well. And then aside from that, we're also a media company. So we own and manage some of the largest Facebook and Instagram pages in the world, which also then we've built out into their own standalone brands. So for example,
obviously that helps because you need the media plus distribution.
Exactly. So that's our huge kind of USP with the agency, is that we have this media arm as well, this great distribution, offering. So we have one of the biggest fitness, for example, publishing groups. We have one of the biggest sports, the biggest food page on Instagram, which now has a huge Facebook presence of, I think, 4 million followers. And our student offering is huge as well. I think we have the fastest growing student community in the world. And so the two companies.
It's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people, yeah. And the two companies kind of work really nicely in tandem together. They do operate as two entities, which has allowed us to kind of focus growth on both. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
again, it's the media side that you own the distribution, the fans and stuff, and then the agency side that helps brands grow, increase revenue.
Exactly that. And the media arm has its other offerings like e-commerce. Less heavy agency work, so just one-off distribution for some videos, for example. Mm-hmm. And it's just allowed us to be much more flexible with the business.
Got it. So what were you like as a kid, and where'd you grow up, and how'd you get into all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think once I tell my kind of background, it all kind of makes sense as mm-hmm. to what I'm doing here now. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in the UK in a place called Manchester, which isn't quite as popular as London here, so everyone still assumes that I'm from London.
UK is just one city.
100%, yeah. People I've known for years still say, oh yeah, so when you go back to London, but that's another story. So yeah, my background, when I was very, very young, probably like 12 or 13, I kind of grew up in that world where the social media was just kind of finding its feet. We had MySpace and things like that that weren't really fully formed.
Right.
And I remember becoming very obsessed with YouTube when it first launched. So those real like early creators that probably aren't around now, people like Charlie Is So Cool, like Neramon, these big British YouTubers who kind of aren't around anymore.
Right.
But I had this obsession, and I started making YouTube videos when I was about 13, which are actually still online, and we don't have to talk about them because they're going to stay hidden forever, I think. But and then aside from that, I was experimenting with just about every social media platform that came out. I just loved the idea that you could create something and receive feedback from strangers, and you had this audience at your fingertips. It was mm-hmm. a creative output that I don't think many people knew about at that time. I felt like it was still really...
How old are you now for the record?
How old am I now? I'm 22 now.
22 now.
Yeah. Okay. So this, I think I was lucky to grow up in a time.
So when you were like 10, MySpace was popular, right?
Yeah. Or 10 was still like dial up internet.
Yeah.
I've always grown up in the countryside in England, so I never had the best internet connection. So I wasn't, so it took me a while to,
But MySpace worked, right?
MySpace worked. MSN Messenger was like, I spent a lot of evenings on MSN Messenger. And the internet was this like crazy place for us back then. And this eventually came onto Twitter. And when Twitter came out, it was the first, social network that went, YouTube I felt was still a very kind of niche community at the time, but Twitter really hit like the mainstream in terms of the news outlets were using it.
2009-ish.
Exactly. And traditional celebrities were adopting it, which it never happened with YouTube or MySpace. So you had these traditional celebrities on it and that really kind of blew up. And that's when I think I was probably 16 at this time. And I was studying for I'm going to say A-levels. And in the US, I believe it's the exams we do before you graduate high school.
There's a few. It's like a countrywide test.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. The whole country does it. And I was very bored revising one day, and I decided to start a Twitter account called Exam Problems. and I basically, it was basically the early days of memes, and I'd make memes about exams. I'd make memes about exams that actually happened that day, and because the whole country did them, they'd get this crazy engagement. There was a huge amount of relevancy. And I'd been creating on the internet for years. I'd done stuff on like Flickr, on YouTube, stuff that no one saw, but all of a sudden this Twitter page blew up. I think I received like 20,000 followers in 2 weeks, which just in the UK, which is more of a kind of echo chamber than the US. So that kind of number was quite impressive.
Yeah.
And that blew up. That went very, very big at the time. And
all natural, right?
All natural, all organic. Paid spend wasn't a thing at the time. There wasn't a huge community where you could share across at the time. So it was all just from, because I was making such relevant content, and it was the real early days of that kind of humor, Twitter stuff. It just really worked. And then one day I got a DM from a guy called Steve Butler, who basically tried to buy the page off me. He offered me a sum of money, which I declined at the time. And we decided to do a deal instead where he would, he would pay me to post links to his website.
What was the audience like, and how much did he want to pay you?
It was, I think by this time it had 60,000 followers.
On Twitter, right?
On Twitter. Okay. And this was a time where posting links on Twitter did something. so it was worth his while. I think the initial offer was, £500 a month.
Okay.
Which I believe is $600, $700.
Yeah. But he offered to buy it for how much?
He offered to buy it for £2,000.
Okay.
I don't know if I should have said that, but I don't think it matters at this stage.
That's okay.
Which for a 16-year-old is a huge amount of money.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, you know,
did you feel like that was, when you heard that he wanted to give you that, were you like, hell no?
There was not even one part of me that wanted to sell that.
Okay, okay.
Because I enjoyed doing it so much. Because,
you know, a lot of people now, like, they make a page and they're 13 years old and like, oh, I'll take $1,000 for this page with a million followers.
Absolutely. But I thought to myself, I enjoyed running it so much.
Yeah.
That I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't pay £2,000 to never play soccer again. It was like a hobby. So I had no chance.
But at this point, you weren't running ads on it, right?
No, nothing. That was, So, and I don't think that really existed back then.
Yeah.
This is like 2012, I want to say.
Because now if I offer to buy a page, they'll say like, well, I make $1,000 a week off ads and it's not worth it because, you know, like.
There's a bit more of a valuation model now. Back then it was a complete wild west.
Well, now like Instagram accounts are seen as businesses.
Absolutely. Media
even
companies.
Though they're totally not like legally, they're not like you don't own anything. You know, it's very risky, but it is seen like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And back then it was just, I imagine he pulled that figure out of the air. I imagine. I think he'd admit that. But I also saw the opportunity. I thought that this, it wasn't worth it because I saw the direction social media was heading, and I knew that there was something that could potentially be built here.
Yeah.
Anyway, and I should give some context into, and this kind of leads on to how Social Chain started, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So Steve, the reason he wanted to pay me to run these ads is because he'd started a business called Wall Park. He was around 18, I think 2 or 3 years older than me, and he'd spent one lecture at university or college and decided he didn't like it. And he wanted to build a website that would take the student kind of notice board online. He saw that people were selling bikes and trying to start five-a-side football teams. And so he decided to start his kind of almost a social platform. And he figured the best way, aside from, you know, flyer marketing or billboards, he thought the best way was going to be through social media. So he decided to come to people like me and pay me to drive, you know, people to his website. He quickly realized that his business model was he was going to take students from these Twitter pages onto his websites and then run ads on the website. But what he then realized, I don't need the website. I can just cut that bit out, cut the middle part out and put ads on the pages. And so then that realization probably came six months to a year after I first met him.
Mm-hmm.
I went off to college in the UK. He had dropped out and he was doing some consulting, and he quickly realized that he could build this network of Twitter pages with people like myself. And so I was at college, and he rang me one day and said, I think I'm going to build a network of pages. And he obviously identified me as someone who knew how to build these communities, and said, do you want to drop out? And I said, yes.
And at this point, your experience in that was what? How many What size were those communities at that point?
So at this point, my page had grown to around 100,000 followers.
The exam problems.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. The exam problems. I'd made a couple of other smaller ones. The person that he'd met to co-found the first business, Wall Park, Don McGregor, who's also now the co-founder of Social Chain.
Okay.
He'd started a student Twitter page called Student Problems. I think that's where I nicked my idea from, basically.
Got it.
That had grown to, I think, around 200,000 followers. And then those two together had started to build a greater network, all with the intention of marketing Wall Park, and kind of by accident built this almost like media conglomerate on Twitter. And it was at this stage they realized they had something. They had this huge opportunity here. So I left university. I didn't really like it very much, which was a bit of a plus. It wasn't a difficult decision for me to make at the time. But of course, it raised a lot of eyebrows, and I went to join these guys. There were about four of us sat in a room in Manchester, and we started to build. We started to build this network even bigger. And
so at this point, the whole company was basically make social pages that have as many people as possible.
We had no monetization plan. We knew that there was value in owning the attention of young people in the UK. So we just thought that this was a huge opportunity and we were doing something right. But it was then that we got emails from Spotify and Copperberg. Copperberg is like a huge cider company in the UK, probably the most popular among students, who wanted to advertise on the pages. And this is when we realized, okay, there's something here. And that's what we started to do. And it kind of accidentally turned into an agency. We never really
did. You even realize that was a thing people did?
No.
And I DM don't think, you and say, hey, we'll pay you to post this.
No, I don't think we did. I think we probably thought it could be, I don't think at the time it was something people did, but we saw the opportunity. We saw, well, this page gets 100,000 people viewing each post.
Yeah.
There's eyes there. So people are going to want to post on here one day. And that's exactly what happened.
What was the original motivation to make the page? Just for fun?
It was, I guess I liked being funny online. Yeah. I liked writing jokes. And which is, it's something I
was. So it's almost like if you like making music, putting out music.
Absolutely.
Just because, yeah.
And it's a great question because I only really came to the answer a few months ago because I thought, why did I do that?
Obviously it changes so much over time.
Yeah, definitely. But if I really think about why I first did it, it wasn't because I wanted to get 60,000 followers or make loads of money. It was because I liked making jokes. That was that, do you know? And then you kind of accidentally learn how to monetize it, and it becomes something you can do for work, which is great.
Right.
And that's what my kind of first role within the company, amongst a few other people, about four or five of us, where we were building these Twitter pages, essentially, you know, kind of mainly UK-based, building this huge network. And we really, I think within 2 or 3 months, we had, I think it was like 8 million followers on Twitter. Because it was the UK, that was really significant. We could control the conversation in the country at that time.
Yeah.
It was extremely powerful.
Wow.
It was crazy powerful. And then really came, you know, months of grinding for clients. Once we had, I think Spotify paid us for a few posts.
Mm-hmm. This is like beginning of Spotify.
Early days. Absolutely. One of the first investors in Spotify, Shaq, is now, you know, a huge friend of ours, huge advisor, because we kind of had that journey together. So it's been...
What's his name?
Shaq. I don't know if that's his real name.
I don't know, probably not. That's cool.
I think we saw the opportunity, but as you know, as any agency knows, these kind of one-off projects don't really secure recurring revenue.
Yeah.
And what we kind of realized that if we were going to go anywhere, we needed like consistent revenue, consistent money. And I think the way we wanted to set about achieving that was doing these one-off projects, but over-delivering a crazy amount. And that's what our first kind of few projects, because we'd almost, and I think it's probably a negative word, but I'm going to use it anyway, we kind of monopolized the UK Twitter space. We really over-delivered for our first few clients.
So kind of guilt them into a monthly thing?
Monthly
retainer?
But more just prove the value of what we do, and then we brought them back in on retainers. And so the first few people we worked with, I remember we were delivering crazy results, but we were blagging it. You know, we were working out and making it up as we went along, because we never really set out to build an agency. That's just what happened. Everyone was doing different jobs. I was managing clients, for example, and I was 18 and had no idea how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing reports with analytics and stuff, and everyone was doing the different things, and it was just this great kind of atmosphere of learning and making it up as we went along.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, and that was, probably 6 or 7 months of just these one-off projects. And
so when was that? When did you guys really come together and say, okay, we're Social Chain?
So this was 2014.
Uh-huh.
I remember it was summer. So I think in April, May 2014 was when we settled in an office in Manchester. We went to this office, which was, it was a co-working space.
Mm-hmm.
We had one table in the middle, very like corporate, not very exciting office. We had surrounded by other businesses. We actually now own that building that we started out in, I'll probably spoil the story, but
that's funny.
We completely took that place over as the years came on. That's where we started, and in Manchester, which was great for me because I grew up in Manchester. My family home was there.
Yeah.
So I kind of just went back, lived at home for a bit, and that allowed, me to be really flexible.
Were a lot of people's goals to get a job in London or somewhere else?
I don't think so. I think the goals of the people that worked at Social... you mean in the UK in general?
Yeah, in the UK.
Yeah, I think London is obviously a huge pull for people.
Right.
But Manchester has really carved out a reputation for tech. You have Social Chain there now, you have Lad Bible, you have Unilad, two of the other biggest publishers in the world.
Bible.
Yeah, all based in Manchester. So it's kind of really carved out this reputation right now. It's obviously cheaper much cheaper standard of living than London, so you can be a lot more agile with your hires. A lot of people see it as a nicer quality of life, which, you know, as someone who lives in New York, you can probably imagine the similarities in living in a slightly less hectic city than London.
It's a little more rural, I guess.
Exactly.
So what was the next kind of big step then in you know, the story?
So the next big step, I'd say, is we started securing clients on retainer. And the minute that we started, during this time as well, we received investment from a German company who really saw, it was from a man who had built Sky Germany, and then he sold that to Rupert Murdoch. And he really saw this as the next kind of step in media. Mm-hmm. He'd seen the way that, you know, print had dominated, then radio, and then TV. And now he saw this was the next step and that we could be one of the huge players in that. And he instilled a huge amount of belief in us. You know, we were still a very scrappy business at this time. And, you know, he really saw that kind of potential. And I think the two next big steps were for us bringing some clients on retainer, branching out. So our work wasn't reliant on the pages we ran. So we began to work with people because we were experts in the field of social media. Mm-hmm. So people wanted to work with us because we knew exactly how to speak to young people, how to create content for them. And that didn't rely on our pages. Yeah. So they could kind of sit on the side. As you know, with any platform, there's every chance that the pages will become, you know, less effective, worthless at some point. Exactly. And that's kind of what happened on Twitter.
Yeah.
But luckily, we probably, you know, a few years, probably a year before that happened, we began to transition to Instagram and Facebook. So we had these kind of flagship Twitter pages that we moved their audiences across to Instagram, mm-hmm. and then we moved it across to Facebook. And what the investment allowed us to do was begin to acquire. So we acquired the biggest food page on Instagram, for example.
Got it.
We acquired one of the biggest sports pages, and that allowed us to really build teams around those brands and almost build them out into full publisher offerings.
That's kind of like, this has to be one of the first companies that's happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like raising money to buy Instagram pages.
Absolutely.
To make, like, that's so crazy.
It's crazy.
It makes total sense now, but 4 years ago, it wouldn't really make sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that
unless you really know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And what you got to realize that 4 years ago is that the value of these pages, the minute we bought them, became instantly more valuable because we had a vision and we had,
and you had clients to put ads.
We had clients, exactly. Yep. And the people that owned the pages back then didn't have that, you know, business acumen. And a lot of them were glad to get rid of the pages because they had this weight over them. They didn't know what to do with them. And that, you know, I think we did a lot of good because we enabled young people who had built great things to you know, make some good money from what they built.
Yeah.
And I think that was a huge passion of ours, was ensuring that young people in this space could do what they did for a living. And so a lot of the people that we acquired the pages off, we employed.
Nice.
So we'd acquire them, we'd bring them on, and they'd build out the network. A lot of the people that we acquired the pages on still work here today and now head up the teams who run those brands, which is hugely, is integral to building this because you couldn't acquire a page off someone who had built it from zero to 10 million
and then
expect to know exactly how to run that page. So we were always very, you know, we always were very considerate in the way we dealt with things. We didn't want to come in aggressively and, you know, take things off people and do our own thing with them.
Yeah.
We made sure that they were always
involved.
Because
in the end, you need that relationship with those people. You don't want to be known as like the big bad wolf.
Absolutely.
Coming to eat your page.
We need it, but we also came from a lot of us came from a background of building those pages. So we knew how it felt. You know, these were our kind of babies. We felt protective over them.
Yeah.
And so it's
crazy how tight that community is of like,
oh, it's
people
crazy.
Who manage big pages. Cause like, I know firsthand, like it's not that many people, you know.
No.
A lot of people own multiple, and then they all know each other, and then they're all using Kick to do deals.
It's a crazy world, and
half of them are like 15 years old.
Absolutely, and you know and being a part of that community has been integral to us growing as a business. I think one of our greatest offerings is not just the pages we own, but the pages we have access to because of the community and the people we know.
Yeah.
And they're all such great people and such an exciting group of people, such, you know, amazing entrepreneurs that I've managed to connect with through that.
So when did it start getting a lot of momentum in the UK, and when did you start thinking about, you know, coming to the US?
So I think what took us from what we call social chain 1.0 to 2.0 was people. So we put a lot of emphasis on appreciating and being humble enough to realize that we had a great knowledge of social media, and we were very young and creative, but we didn't know how to talk like a big agency, or, you know, act like a big agency. Yeah. And we didn't know how to get the right doors open, exactly what a product was. So we started to bring in people from the traditional agency world, from the traditional media world, convince them to join us and really kind of build the company. So to we made
kind
some,
of get some respect.
Get some respect,
from,
exactly.
From other people, yeah.
Exactly. And what we realized was we could bring in one great person and they would completely change our product. They'd completely change our offering. I remember when we first hired our first Facebook paid guy, who's still with the company now. He heads up our whole strategy department. It completely changed our offering. We suddenly realized that we could sell Facebook paid on top of everything we do. He taught everyone in the business.
And that can be a lot of business.
Absolutely. That's a business in itself.
Yeah.
But convincing these people who, you know, had great secure jobs at huge agencies to come and join a 1.5 2 year old company
was difficult. People from other
agencies. We were taking agencies from, you know, places like Mediacom, you know, the biggest McCann biggest agencies in the UK and Europe, mm-hmm. which was difficult. But what we put so much emphasis on was our culture, and because we offered this alternative to the traditional way of working, you know, there was so much excitement in the company. It was a very friendly, very warm place to work.
And that was very different than the other
company. Completely different. And these people came, they saw the office, they met the people, and they were sold. And, you know, a lot of them took, you know, lesser, you know, packages than they currently had, yeah. because they believed in the business. And, you know, mm-hmm. That's been, you know, huge, obviously being paid back to them in because of the work they've done for us.
Yeah.
And so convincing those people to come in, being humble enough to realize that despite the fact that we were the young kids who built this, we need people to come in and tell us what to do, which isn't an easy thing to do. And for a lot
right.
of people,
or sometimes you need to look the part and act the part.
Absolutely. I think this is a great point, is that you need to understand your prejudices, understand the prejudice people have on you.
Yeah.
So it's all great thinking that, I think that someone who runs a big company, who's a marketing director and been in the business for 20 years, should listen to what I say just because I think I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's not the case, because I look like I'm 19 because I was 19, and I need to accept that. So I need to play, and I'm not going to change
understanding
that.
Understanding your strengths and
exactly.
Like we did a similar thing with our company, where like I'm 24, my co-founder is 24 as well. And we actually, our investor, who's like about 8 or 10 years older than us, is now working with us. You know, he's now our CFO. So that changes everything, because now we're like, we have a CFO who can give you really professional, you know, reports on all of our shit.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it changes. We use that to it. Even though we know that, you know, like all of us know what we're doing in our own space, but like we can use that to appeal to a different type of audience. Mm-hmm.
And I think
whether it's an investor or a client or whatever,
that's exactly it. And I think there's two types of people: the kind of person who, when that person comes in over them, despite the fact that they've been at the company longer, one person lets their ego get in the way and doesn't like that. The other person realizes that this actually makes them look much better. Yeah. If I walk in the room with someone with 10 years experience and we both present, yeah. I look 10 times smarter than I ever did,
right.
because my work's been validated by this person who believes in
right.
me.
Right.
So it was that for me was, and I think that everyone at the company would agree, what really took us to the next level mm-hmm. was pairing the youth with the wisdom.
What were some of the pivotal moments in the beginning, like the big clients that you got or like big moments like that where, you're like, man, like this is huge. Like, were there any like huge clients that you got way back that were,
to be honest,
that changed the game?
The it's difficult to say, because every single big client, and by big client, I mean someone who pays us monthly to do their whole digital strategy. They all came from us doing one-off projects. So we had to get our foot in the door initially.
Okay.
So it's difficult to really pinpoint those moments.
So you always did some like one-off project before
yes.
signing them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I think for the best, I think just off the top of my head, one of the those real big brands that really validated us was working with Comedy Central, which was probably mm-hmm. one of the first campaigns I did personally, which was, I don't even know the show Impractical Jokers.
Yeah.
It's like huge over here. But they were just launching in the UK for the first time.
Okay.
And we kind of built their social media strategy there. You know, it's such a great show and it makes so much sense because you can cut the clips into like yeah. digestible pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And we did all
easy
that.
Easy micro content.
Absolutely. Yeah. We did all that, distributed it on Twitter, Instagram. And I remember it top trended in the UK all night. We got an email the next day from the head of, the head of comedy. It was through McCann, through an agency. And he emailed us and said that, you know, they haven't seen viewing figures like that since the early days of Two and a Half Men. And it was just this huge
validation.
Someone
from Twitter?
No, someone from Comedy Central.
From Comedy Central,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
And it was this huge moment of, this product yeah. is moving the needle.
Like, ooh, they're happy.
yay, they're happy. But also we weren't just running vanity metrics. We weren't just getting impressions and retweets. We were making people change behavior. And that's because we knew exactly how to speak to them.
And so you said that was made a big impact on the viewership.
A huge impact on the viewership. They said, you know, and because we saw it was top trending in the UK on Twitter, mm-hmm. which back in those days that actually dictated what people watched. Probably less so now, but it was a huge, you know.
So after that, they're like, take our money.
It was So the relationship like developed from there. Uh-huh. Exactly. But it put a lot of confidence in
that
our
was
product.
A one-off thing to promote that show.
Yeah, that was one-off initially, and I remember looking back now. I recently looked at the proposal we wrote for them, and it was not good. You know, it was very scrappy. And
did you feel like when you wrote those first proposals to the big clients that you got like the package right and the pricing right?
No.
You feel like it was way too low?
I don't think it was low in relation to who we were. We knew who we were.
Yeah.
We didn't expect these people to have to.
It's always interesting because sometimes you think it's like, oh, I don't want. I think charging them $10,000 is way too much. And then they're like, what, 10?
Yeah,
I thought it was
going to
be like 50.
Absolutely.
On their end, but you never know that.
Never. So. But it made a lot of sense for us because we had to prove ourselves. We were the new kids on the block.
How did what was the strategy behind giving those first packages though?
You
take advice from someone or?
Yeah. So I think we made a few very initial hires of, you know, salesmen from agencies who kind of guided us. But in the early days, it was difficult for them to fully understand our product. So I think in the early days, it was a lot of kind of making it up. And
that's being
very honest there. Simply because there was no market rate for this.
Yeah.
We were running a Twitter campaign before Twitter campaigns really existed.
Everyone's making everything up all the time.
Well, I think less so now, but yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Unless,
I know what you mean.
Unless you can like say, okay, it's this CPM impression.
Yeah, exactly.
It's guaranteed impression. Yeah.
Yeah. But you're right. Back then we undercharged hugely because number one, we didn't know what the results were going to be always.
Yeah.
But we wanted to prove the product and that was hugely important for us.
Yeah.
And then I think what followed from there was because we kind of got these clients under our belt, we had a bit of capital and we managed to convince these very experienced, very good people to come on mm-hmm. and work for us. Things just went to the next level.
I could imagine that's cool because literally if you get a client that's $10,000 a month, even like mm-hmm. that pays for someone's salary.
Absolutely.
You can now hire another person if you want.
Exactly.
That's huge.
Yeah. And that's exactly how it was. So you'd bring someone on and pay that salary, but the product would go up a level and we'd be able to charge, five X what they would cost for us.
Yeah.
We really built a reputation in the UK for knowing the social space better than anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And a huge reason for this is because we decided quite early, it wasn't quite early, it's probably halfway through the business, in terms of its lifetime now, but we decided to split the agency with the media.
Right.
So we, unlike a lot of media companies, or I call them new media companies, so media companies on social media, we had built the agency from the start. So we had this great agency who built a reputation for doing very good creative work, very innovative work as well. And we split the agency from the media and created two kind of separate companies.
One which had the client work and one which you owned the
Exactly.
Facebook pages or whatever.
Exactly. And that allowed us to really focus on building the media, but also building the agency without kind of getting too distracted. Mm-hmm. It also allowed us, for example, the agency could work with other media companies and the media company could work with other agencies. So they weren't seen as competitors.
And then also, if you have a client that it's a restaurant or something, mm-hmm. and needs promo on the food page, you don't need to,
exactly.
it's not another expense to pay the influencer.
That's exactly it. We don't need to spend someone's time as an account manager going through the client stuff. Yeah. We can be much more agile.
Definitely the less people you involve, the easier.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
One, just the client is like bad enough.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh God, the time that would have been lost. Yeah. It's crazy. And so that was huge for us, was separating the two and focusing growth. Uh-huh. And that allowed us to bring on even better people. So, you know, we were able to convince people from the media world to come and join the media company, mm-hmm. and sell them on the vision and say, this is going to be the next big kind of media company. And then the UK really became this kind of self-sufficient machine from there. We developed this amazing reputation for doing, you know, being the first movers in social media. I think since I've been in the US, I've learned that the US is a much more mature market in social media world. But I like to think that Social Chain in the UK is up to date as the US is.
Got it.
So we kind of offer that insight to all the UK and Europe clients.
So fast forward to today, obviously you live in New York.
Live in New York today.
Right. So how did that happen?
So just as we became this kind of self-sufficient machine where, you know, the real kind of grinding, scrappy days just kind of started to end. We looked at our media properties and we kind of realized that most of our audience were actually in the States. They were in the US. We were growing much quicker in the US than we were anywhere else.
In terms of the media side?
Yeah, in terms of the media side. So our followers were all US-based, pretty much.
Okay.
It was about 60% US. Mm-hmm. And we also obviously identified America and the States as the biggest market for the agency as well.
Yeah.
So it made complete sense. We said, literally a month before I moved, Steve, our CEO, said to me, do you want to move to New York to launch it in the US? And I just got comfortable. We just stopped these like scrappy days of hustling and, you know, building the thing. And I just said, yeah. And that was it.
Have you ever been to New York before that?
I'd never been to America before
oh my
that.
God.
The first time I stepped foot in the States was to move there to live in New York.
Wow.
Which was, and you know, I was 20 at the time.
That's cool.
And it was an opportunity I couldn't say no to.
I had another person on the podcast with a similar story. That his name is Cody Jensen. He's a YouTuber, but they lived in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. and they literally just like they visited New York a few times, but they were like, all right, like we got to go. And they just packed up their whole house and moved.
That's
and
crazy.
Like, he thought that they could just show up and go, walk into an office and rent an apartment.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. But
sometimes you just, sometimes you got to take the leap.
Exactly.
What's the worst that could happen?
Well, you're right.
You know, you're not going to get killed or you know?
And I think we realized that. I think we, in the same vein that we started the company in the UK, we went into it deliberately naively. We just kind of arrived, said, right, we're going to live there and we're going to get an office there.
But did you have any potential clients set up here or meetings set up or anything?
Honestly, when we first came, not really.
Okay.
We had a lot of interest. So another one of the reasons we came was because a lot of our clients in the UK and Europe obviously wanted us to start helping them with their US offerings.
So you did have potential clients.
We did in from the UK and Europe, not actually in the States. But you're right, we had potential clients.
Yeah, you were like, you know, we'll figure it out because we do have clients that can
exactly,
pay us.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
It was never going to be a problem in that sense.
Yep.
You know, we came here, there was about three of us that came. Two of us permanently. Steve was coming back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And
who's the other people?
So a guy called Michael Heaven.
And he was doing
the way it was going to work is I kind of was going to focus on building out the product, so the media side, because obviously that's what my first background came in the UK. I was running the campaign team, so I was running the team that executed on the agency side. So I'd come out here to build out our kind of production, our agency, creative. You know, making sure that we're, you know, using the platforms right, things like that.
Yep.
But I spent probably the first 6 months really nailing down our product, mm-hmm. meeting just about everyone in the media space, meeting just about every entrepreneur I knew who'd built these communities in a similar way that we did. and just really figuring out what the market needed and where we fit.
It's really interesting that maybe it's the same in Manchester or London, but like in New York and Los Angeles, especially the network is so important.
So important.
You know, like it's, you just don't even exist if you don't have it. You know what I mean? It's like you're never going to have any clients, any notoriety, any PR,
exactly,
any marketing. Did you know that coming here?
We probably didn't. We probably thought we had a little more.
Kind of just set up shop and get going.
Yeah. I think we knew it was going to be a task. What we learned pretty quickly is that the US space is a lot more mature. Mm-hmm. So we learn, I think we...
They don't ooh and ah at your stuff
they
as
don't
much.
Care. They don't care how old we are and how impressive our story is, because there are, you know, loads of people who've right. built what we built at that age. So
I suppose, yeah.
Sorry. And then, so, yeah. And I think we realized pretty quickly that the social media space was a lot more mature. So people knew a lot more. We'd go to brands and they'd understand what we were talking about. Yeah. In the UK and Europe, when we pitched, it wasn't always the case. And that's why we were such an attractive proposition.
Uh-huh.
So we came here and we realized we really had to nail down what our USP would be. I think when we first,
what's USP?
A unique selling point. Okay. Sorry. So like, what is it about us that makes us completely different to anyone else? Why would they work with us over someone else? And we realized pretty quickly, we were told by a lot of agencies we met with, don't call yourself an influencer marketing agency, because there was a lot of them. And I think that was one of the key things you did, was we took that vocabulary out.
It's probably too true today too.
It probably is true today. Yeah, absolutely.
Because there's just so many people who can claim that and exactly. not deliver. It's bad. Even if you can deliver, it's you're grouped with a bunch of potential fake.
Exactly.
You know,
and you're right. There's so much choice in terms of the influencer marketing.
What do you think about that, by the way? Because I mean, I see people all the time on Facebook that say, like, I'm not going to call anyone out, but people who say like half a billion Facebook network, 100 million Facebook. And I'm like, I know you don't own those pages. What do you think about people who do that?
I don't think it really matters, because they're going to get found out either way. So it's something that we did. We used to talk about, we used to put a number on our network a lot. You know, we had this many million followers.
Yeah.
But we quickly realized that wasn't really doing much for anyone, because that number doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. And when it's hundreds of millions, no one can wrap their head around it.
Exactly.
Or believe you. They might not believe you.
Yeah, absolutely. But what people do buy into is the strength of the brand. So we've built these social media pages that have a really clear tone of voice. They have a really clear brand about them. Mm-hmm. They have, you know, we have like faces to them now, people who present on them regularly, and that's what people really buy into. And the viewing figures will come second.
How many pages do you guys own now, and what's the audience in different categories?
I think I honestly couldn't put a number on the amount of pages we own.
It's hundreds.
It's hundreds, yeah. But we have, I'd probably say, 20 to 30 real flagship pages with, you know, millions of followers. Some of our strongest offerings, one of them I mentioned earlier in students, is a page called Student Problems, which on Facebook just hit 8 million followers, and that also has offerings on Instagram and Twitter. I think that's like 2 or 3 million.
So then like all the student pages combined,
exactly,
have how many?
Probably 15 million combined.
And then like all the food is
food is slightly bigger. I think it's like 16-17 million. The Instagram page has 9 million, I want to say.
In each one of these, you're diversified between the platforms.
Absolutely. Yeah. Every single platform has its own audience.
For people who don't know why you do that, how would you explain that strategy? Like, why don't you just have 20 million in Facebook, not care about Instagram?
I think because you have different behaviors on each platform. People use those platforms for different reasons. So Facebook, we know, is a place where people will go to watch a lot of videos, and they probably have longer sessions. I'd say there's a certain demographic on Facebook of people that make their purchase decisions via Facebook. So Facebook makes a lot of sense for us, because we have you have a lot of data on your audience, and you can push ads through them that get you much better results. You can push sales through them. Whereas Instagram is an amazing brand awareness play, and you can kind of, you know, produce and distribute content that completes a whole different task to what the Facebook stuff does. But also it's very important to diversify, because you just don't know where the platforms are going. No one can predict that. And we spent months and months building out this huge Twitter network, which did 95% of our revenue in the early days. And that's, you know, honestly, it was probably 100%. And now it does 0%. We do no business on Twitter at mm-hmm. all. And if we hadn't diversified, we wouldn't be a business today.
And that you accredit that to just natural, you know, the platform becomes more people, more marketers, gets devalued, and now it's not as valuable.
Yeah, the Twitter space, yeah. If you know it well, got crowded by advertisers.
There's a life cycle to these.
Absolutely. I think there's less of a life cycle on some places like Facebook and Instagram, just because the ad offering from the platforms themselves are quite good and quite mature. Mm-hmm. So you don't get people, posting bad ads. Twitter was completely unregulated.
Yeah.
So it was, and because Twitter's ad offering was bad, people had to post through these pages, and the pages would post really, you know, poor quality products, poor quality ads, poor quality clicks. That numbs the user to that behavior. So people stopped using it.
Yeah.
And I also think what's a huge, the reason Facebook and Instagram are hugely different to Twitter is the rise of video. Yeah. And I think that if you can market well through video, it's a much nicer experience for the customer.
What do you think about Instagram TV?
I think that Instagram TV makes so much sense for a few reasons. I think that...
It's funny that we talk about Facebook and Instagram like they're different companies. But
yeah, I know.
The same, you know, the same company... Just different products.
Same ecosystem.
They all offer photo, video, text.
Well, it's funny. Instagram, I think, Instagram is going to become, in my head, much bigger than Facebook for a number of reasons. I think it's going down the WeChat route. So, like, for example, they're slowly releasing features which are just kind of bringing the consumer in to cover everything. So they have video chat now. That was released like last week.
Right.
So you can message your friends there because you can already do that. They have basically a Snapchat in the app.
Yeah.
They just today launched, literally today, about 3 p.m., you can now post a story with music playing in the background that's already loaded on through, I think, Spotify or it might be Apple Music.
Oh, wow.
So that's they've just gone for Musical.ly. And now you kind of, they kind of poach that kind of, Musical.ly's unique selling point. You know, they're slowly introducing commerce. So you have product tags right now.
Yep.
This is was massively beneficial for us because we spend so much of our time building audiences on Instagram for our clients. A lot of the questions we get is this actually doing anything for us? The minute the product tags dropped, we were like, well, listen.
They have analytics.
Exactly, analytics. But you know, we've just got you 100,000 followers on Instagram. They can now literally buy directly, you know, through the app. And it won't be long before Instagram actually introduce, being able to pay through Instagram. And that's already been announced. That's what's going to come soon. So people will be able to launch stores through there. I just think it's going to become a one-stop shop. You have Instagram TV, which is, you know, their kind of take on YouTube.
Yeah. I think that, like, in terms of, you know, how Facebook steals everything, like,
yeah,
In one way, I feel like it's a little bit distasteful the way they do it. But in the end, it's not unfair because the consumer is always right. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like I sit here saying, you know, Mark shouldn't have stole that from Evan, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Evan Spiegel.
Yeah.
But I don't use Snapchat. So I'm voting with my usage, and
you can't.
So I don't know what to say.
Exactly. You can't own the concept of, you know, Snapchat stories. That's not something you can own. In the same way, you can't own the feed.
And I kind of wish Evan Spiegel would speak out a little bit more.
Yeah,
I really want to know what he's thinking. Like, dude, speak up for yourself.
Yeah,
Do you feel like he stole it, or I just want to know what he thinks.
What Evan thinks. I think that when it first happened, he thought, this is fine. We've got this many users.
Yeah.
They can do their thing. People have copied us before.
Obviously, it's a huge compliment too.
Absolutely.
It's like, I mean, let's get it straight. Like he's fine. Like he's not going to be living under a bridge because of this, you know, and the company's still going to be a big company, but.
Yeah. At the time it would have validated his vision, I think.
Yeah.
What I think the moment that the graph started to, slowly decrease and Instagram slowly increased, he probably thought, oh God, I've lost a lot of users here. And he did. I was one of them. Yeah. I use Snapchat stories every single day. Yeah. And now I don't touch it. I don't open the app anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I remember what I was doing on Snapchat with this. I made Snapchat filters for DJ Khaled.
Yeah. That's actually how I heard about you in the first place.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was doing that. I mean, we got hundreds of millions of views for free, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
But now it's like, I don't need it.
I think that, and if you read the statistics within people under 20, I think like the 13 to 19 year olds do use Snapchat more. There is still that audience there that they still,
and it is still growing internationally. Absolutely. I heard.
And through messaging, I don't think Evan ever set out to build a platform for publishers or a platform for influencers.
Yeah.
He really wanted to focus on messaging.
Yeah.
And that is still a huge use case for them. And marketers shouldn't forget that.
And I feel like Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook are more about like take over the whole world. We want everyone from 12 years old to 100 years old. I think like I have friends who are, you know, 17, 18, 16, and people I know in that age range, and they still use Snapchat a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some of them don't use Instagram.
Yeah, no, we've
definitely
seen the same.
Not stories. Maybe they'll post once a week or something.
Mm-hmm.
But their daily messaging is still done in Snapchat with their friends.
That's crazy. And it's the same with Facebook. Their use for younger people is heavily declining. So it's interesting to see, you know, how this is going to play out.
I barely use it now.
Facebook.
Yeah, really? I only use it. I check it maybe once a week to make sure I'm not invited to some event or a message. But I use it for the All Things Social Media group or some other Facebook groups.
Yeah, yeah.
But not daily.
You're right, and I think a lot of the time that whenever I do use Facebook, which is much much less than I use Instagram or Twitter, for example, I'll usually close the app and think, what have I actually just consumed? Nothing of any value.
It's just big time wasters.
I haven't seen anything that my friends are doing. The content I'm fed is random or feels random.
That's the problem too.
Yeah.
They need to come out with a way to filter your friends. Like I have 2,000 friends on Facebook.
It's crazy.
I'm like, I don't know any of these people. You know what I mean? Like, I wish I could start over, you know, and just add my mom, my friend, you know, like 10 people, 20, 30 people, maybe 50, but, you know, not 1,000.
It's almost too late, isn't it?
Because when I was younger, it was fine to add everyone. It was okay. But now it's like, I don't know.
Yeah,
the platform just changed and the content is so bad.
Mm-hmm. And this speaks more to the point of diversifying.
Yeah.
This is why you have to, you can't, you know, put all your eggs in one basket because you just don't know how the platform's going to change, but also how the user behavior is going to change.
So what's the, getting back to social chain in the US now, so what's kind of the big initiative now, and at what stage are you at in the US here?
So we've been here a year and a half now. We are around 30 people, split between the agency and the media business as well. We're at a stage right now where we've got a few clients on retainer. Some of them have come from our work in the UK, and we've helped them launch in the US and really build a presence here. And from that, we've also brought on clients over here as well. The media recently launched e-commerce, which was a huge something we've been you know, planning to do for a long, long time, which makes a lot of sense, particularly in the States, because, you know, that's a huge, huge market for us. So we're kind of just at that stage, as I talked about in the UK, where we're starting to marry the youth and the social media knowledge with the experience of more, people who have been here for a while.
Right.
For the first year and a half, we were bouncing around WeWorks. We started in a room with literally four desks. It was an internal room, so we had no windows. It was very, very depressing. But it felt, you know, it was really motivating. It was like a game of escape the room, the longest game of escape the room I've ever played. And we gradually grew, so that as we brought in a bit of revenue, we moved to a 6-person office, then an 8-person office. Then we had this place in WeWork in Soho, which had around 15 desks.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we finally kind of gradually got some...
WeWork Soho, that's the first one.
Was it?
Yeah. Well, there's two in Soho.
Oh, but, well, it's the one that wasn't the first one. It's South Soho. Yeah, okay. I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
But WeWork was amazing for us. You know, it was such a godsend to be able to grow and so nimbly like that, to be able to...
Yeah, we were in WeWork for like 14, 18 months. Really? Something like that. Oh my God. I've given WeWork so much money.
Yeah.
Like $50,000 at least.
Yeah, it's crazy.
At least 50K.
It's crazy.
Oh my God. It hurts to even think about. That's so much money.
I know.
Oh my God.
But it makes a lot of sense to, you know, to scale.
Yeah. And we would get these emails that are like crazy promotions, like commit to a year and we'll double your space for free.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah.
Like, what?
Yeah. And that's what we were very good at, is that we developed very close relationships from day one.
Oh yeah. I negotiated the hell out of their office every month.
I think when a company who makes as much revenue as they do, they can kind of have that with them. Yeah. But we were also lucky that our growth in the UK was a good case study. So we could go to WeWork and say, mm-hmm. you can grow with us. You know,
hey, we have hundreds of employees at
exactly,
home.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is how we,
how many employees are in UK now?
So yeah, I think the UK, in the year and a half I've been in the US building the business here, the UK has really rocketed as, you know, as a kind of European sort of social media powerhouse. It's, mm-hmm. it's actually the biggest, social media agency in the UK for revenue as of this year, which is quite exciting.
That's crazy.
Yeah, really crazy.
So social media agency, meaning so it's not like traditional?
No, not traditional. Okay. Yeah, traditional agency, obviously there are, you know, much, much bigger agencies who make, right. You know.
But social first.
Social kind of, first yeah. marketing agency. Yes, we've overtaken a few agencies that have been around for a bit longer. We have offices in London now as well, office in Berlin. The German ad market is huge. It's actually bigger than the UK, so that we identified that as a place to go to. Office in Munich. So there are four offices across Europe right now. Mm. And there's about 180 people overall, with around 130 of those in Manchester in our headquarters. Uh-huh. And as I said earlier, that small white. And
how many in New York right now?
In New York, there's 30 of us.
Okay.
Yeah. So we, after the WeWork kind of era, we moved into our own space, which is hugely important to us, as I mentioned earlier, because we really now need to.
Because you need to differentiate the culture.
We need to differentiate the culture. Culture is the huge driver of our success. And it helps convince people who have very secure jobs at great, you know, huge media companies to come and join us and come and be a part of this. It's a little easier now because of the success in the UK, but, you know, we have to protect our culture. And I think I realized that.
Yeah.
Moving over to the US, one of the big questions was, how are we going to be as successful as we were in the UK in a completely different market where nobody knows us?
Yeah.
And that's by bringing over the culture and the values.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that's transferable.
Even in New York today, or before you guys were here, like it's a huge difference between working at, you know, Ogilvy versus like VaynerMedia, you know, totally
absolutely.
Different.
Absolutely.
So it's like some people want to, hey, I want to wear a suit and be like Mad Men, and some people don't care.
Yeah, exactly. That's
and
it.
Some people want more chill.
Some people want more chill. Exactly. And I think we make a lot of our business decisions based on the kind of greater good of the culture. So for example, mm-hmm. we believe that it's better, you know, to let go of somebody who might cost us a lot of money in the short term because they're bringing in, you know, they're an amazing salesperson, for example. It makes more sense to let go of them now, suffer in the short term, but do better for the culture because he isn't, or that person isn't, you know, creating a warm environment.
Yeah.
And so that's something we've always been hugely driven by. And it was one of the reasons why moving over to the US, and it was integral that someone like myself who saw the growth in the UK was here to kind mm-hmm. of drive home those values and protect that culture.
Got it. So now you, now you're still aggressively hiring here?
Yes. Even more so than this is probably our most aggressive.
What are you looking for?
I guess that question changes every time we sign a new client.
Mm-hmm.
But right now all the work we've done so far, we've, in terms of production, we do a lot of content production. We basically mm-hmm. outsourced everything. That was basically until the point that we felt it was as much of a demand, to bring our own production in house. And that's what we're doing now. So we're now really focusing on building out like an A production team. So that's like building out a video team, a great design team.
To do commercials, creative.
Like we create a huge amount of content.
Yeah.
We run, you know, Instagram accounts for several brands. We do a lot of big viral activations, which means a lot of video work. And our media side as well. So the media, in the UK, our media team is a huge team of people creating content for our media assets. We're now really trying to focus on building
content. It's a lot of work
to
creative.
Absolutely.
Even for one client, it could be hundreds of different pieces a month.
Absolutely. And
Instagram swipe ups, Facebook ads.
It's crazy. And right, and you know, it's been okay doing that right now, outsourcing. Mm-hmm. But if you
outsource
really want
to who? What, some so, huge company is doing?
No, so we have a few contacts. So like we have a video team that we'll always use.
They're like contractors.
Exactly, for, okay. In New York that we'll always use.
Got it.
We have, you know, freelance designers. We also lean on our UK team every now and then. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're a very established team. And if there's something, a really important piece of work that mm-hmm. we feel needs extra attention from a group of people that we trust and we know who are going to understand what the output needs to look like, we'll use the UK. But obviously that means that you lose a little bit of quality control and you lose a little bit of that flair that, you know, that mm-hmm. is the reason people work with us. So now we're kind of building, you know, bringing everything in house. I think one thing New York taught us is that you can't be as aggressive with hiring as we perhaps were in a place like Manchester in the UK because of salaries, basically.
Yeah.
It's a very, you know, very, you have to get the hires right and you have to be very much more strategic.
Yeah. And it's a really... It really can crush someone if you fire them.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know,
here.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's, you can't.
You want to keep your reputation up.
You want to keep your reputation up. Yeah. You don't want to, you can't go around hiring left, right, center, and then you have to let four or five of those people go. That's bad for everyone.
And then when you start getting into tech like we are, it's like even worse.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
Not that we don't hire anyone externally, but when we do, it's not going to be cheap.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like $150,000 all in
that's
for one
crazy.
Person.
That's
you know?
Crazy. Yeah. Mm.
If we wanted to hire like a 30-year-old full-time developer.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah.
Cause like we could do the small things. It's like, we want to hire someone that like takes us up a level.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So.
And that's the point. But if they do take up that level,
and
they're
so
worth
do you,
it.
Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. And it's always worth it if they do take up that level.
Yeah. And I mean, like I think it's similar, like in tech, like when you're developing products, which, you know, a lot of companies are tech companies now, mm-hmm. but like the difference between an average developer and like a great developer is like insane.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, we're talking like there's so many examples. One like legendary example is like Gmail at Google was like a side project of a developer.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? And then like he made that himself and then he presented it. And like an average developer would have never even taken the initiative.
Absolutely not.
You know, so like have like that, like it can, you get what you pay for in a way, but mm-hmm. like once you find that perfect fit, like you gotta go with them.
Exactly.
Because it can be better than hiring five other people.
No,
that's what I know.
Yeah, and
now at least.
And I think you're right. I think that applies for, you know, a lot of kind of industries and a lot of kind of verticals as well.
And even though we're not hiring people right now, it's still the same when we work with anyone.
You yeah,
know what
absolutely.
I mean? Like I would much rather have deal with like we're a 3-person team now. We mm-hmm. used to be 9, mm-hmm. right? They weren't full time or anything. They were interns or part time, sure. whatever, or friends working with us, right? But like, in the end, sometimes it's just more worth it to have a few people really committed,
yeah.
and just you can count on, you know,
completely right. And
sounds like that's how it started with you guys.
It is, and I think amongst all the what has kind of underpinned all of that whole story and that whole process is we have been very protective over the quality of our work.
Yeah.
We understand that we are only as good as the worst piece of work we put out.
Yeah.
So the minute that we put out,
you could lose a client at any time.
Absolutely. And I think the best people know that of themselves. I know that I'm only as good as the worst piece of content that our agency puts out because mm-hmm. that's how I'm going to be judged.
Yeah.
So we've been very, very protective over the work we do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two more questions. One is, what was the, I ask a lot of people this, like what was the hardest point for you personally in the whole process of this whole thing?
The hardest point, I honestly, it has never really felt, I've never really felt like I was making the wrong decision. Mm-hmm. I suppose that the hardest point was the very short period of time just after I left university, not because I didn't believe in what we were doing, but because I kept being asked by people and I kept having to answer for what we were doing. So like, you know, I went to a school where you're expected to go to university and you haven't mm-hmm. succeeded unless you graduate with a great degree and then you get a great job.
Uh-huh.
And I did well to get to a good university and I left after 2 months to join, who were, you know, an amazing team, but no one knows that, right? No one outside knows that. And when people ask you what you do and I say I'm building Twitter accounts, you can imagine the looks you get.
I have no idea.
And it never, never deterred me from what I was doing. I was so confident, but just having to have those conversations with people who didn't really understand the
space. It gets tiring after a while.
It's exhausting, yeah. And even now...
You just want to leave them eventually.
Yeah, definitely. And even now, I'll go back home and people will grill me. Still grill me. Why are you doing that? You know, what is it exactly doing? Do you just sit around on tweet all day? And the funny thing is,
it doesn't even have to do with your success. It's like, even if you were making $10 million a year, they'd still say the same
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. It doesn't
still
matter.
Still say the same thing.
Yeah. People don't see what they know, see beyond what they know.
Yeah.
I think we've, as a business, we've had difficult points. I remember we had a point in the UK just as we were kind of growing and building, where we had our emails hacked. Which wasn't nice.
Your company emails.
One of the founders had their email compromised, and then some emails were sent to a few clients. Quite a calculated attack.
Wow.
We never found out exactly who did that, but we have obviously suspicions. And that, but there was this, and we were, when you're that early on in the process.
Who hated you guys that much?
We don't know. But when you're that early on in the process, Gary V. suddenly, I don't think we were quite on his radar at that point. I think that'd be a compliment if that was him. But yeah, there was a moment where we could have lost all our clients. But
my God.
But we have, you know, two amazing founders who kept very level-headed. And I think in that moment, they taught me one of the best lessons I've ever learned is that the really great leaders and the really great entrepreneurs are people who, when things are really good or when things are really bad, they stay in the middle. So you never believe the hype, but you also never let the bad times really get to you. You just have to stay neutral. You can celebrate the good times and you can, show a little bit of annoyance or anger, but you should never, you know, allow it to affect your work or affect your performance. You've just got to stay neutral. And by doing that, we got through it. And, you know, it meant that you could have a clear head and we worked out what the solution was. We stayed and we rang every single client, and we, you know, some of them didn't believe that it was a hack. So we did lose a couple of clients that day, but it was a lesson.
Even after they knew it was,
they didn't believe us. Some of them didn't believe us, and this is because
were they like insulting the clients or something bad like that?
Yeah, it was very, very very calculated.
It's like they were trying to get
they were trying to lose the clients. They knew what these people knew what they were doing. And I think it was just someone jealous because we really kind of shook the UK market up a bit.
Yeah.
You know, we came out of nowhere and the growth was you know, quite explosive. So yeah.
Now you guys have two-factor authentication on.
We have every single cybersecurity measure under the sun. Yes. And these moments are amazing lessons. Not just in the practical things like cybersecurity, but also just in how to deal with these moments.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there are people...
Especially with the clients, you never know. Because it's not up to you all the time.
Definitely
the
not.
The last second that can be like, we need to change everything.
Oh, crazy. And client work is it's very, you know...
Who has clients.
Yeah, you know it, exactly. You know it.
But it could be annoying, but also it's like, you know... We want to do it. It's like the business.
Of course.
You know, like it's got to learn to deal with it.
And you learn so much by dealing with clients. You learn so much.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I know a lot of people who've worked on agencies and also on the brands. And it's like they say, like, once they go to the brand side, it's like a holiday and they feel so well prepared because they've worked at an agency. So I think and that's always a piece of advice people give is always do the agency first. Mm. Always get treated, you know, a bit badly here and there. You know, it's a lot more work, and then you can go to the brand side and you'll be prepared for anything.
What I've learned is that sometimes the clients just, they ask you questions that they know the answer to. They just want to like check.
Yeah, of
course.
You know
what I mean? So they'll be like, hey, can we just switch up this whole project at the last second? And then you'd be like, you know, no, that's not possible. And then they'll be like, okay.
And
you know, they're not like trying to push. They're just like trying to bounce things off of you. Like
exactly.
And if, when you don't take it personally, it shouldn't affect you. You know
Absolutely
what I mean?
It's true.
Like, they're just trying to get their money's worth.
They're just like, and that's their job. Their job from their, you know, the person who deals with the agency, they've been employed by their company to get the most money, to get the most value from the money they're spending.
Right.
So they're paid to be assholes.
In the end, what I like is that in the end, it's a symbiotic relationship. You know,
of
like
course.
You need each other.
Absolutely.
In the end. You know, otherwise, you split up. That's so true. And I'm sure that happens with some clients. Of course. It doesn't work out. But
the clients that we work with and have worked with in the past, we're very grateful to because they took a risk on us.
Yeah.
We always were kind of this alternative agency. Yeah, yeah, we're 2 years old, you know, there's no reason. It's very difficult to become somebody's agency of record when they already have a really, you know, strong offering. So the clients that we do work with long-term, we have clients who we've worked with for 3 years now and we're best friends because they believed in us and we've delivered for them, you know, 10x what they spent with us. So it's exactly.
That's how it should be.
Exactly.
So, all right. Last question is I ask everyone, do you have any questions for me? Anything?
Oh, okay.
Open book.
What was the most difficult point for you?
Oh my God.
Personally, in your journey?
Every day.
Because that was a difficult question for me. So
every day. I mean, let's see. Honestly, it's probably right now. I mean, because I'm not talking about day to day, but sure. on the big scale, it's definitely right now because I'm at a point where like I'm all in on everything, mm-hmm. you know, with what I'm doing, and it's just like nothing but upside, you know.
Of course, yeah.
So like it's like the longer you delay gratification, the more like leverage you have on it. You know what I mean?
That's a good point.
And I'm at the point of like, I've been delaying it for like years.
Yeah.
You know? You know what I mean? So like I've been living at home, not taking mm-hmm. salary, mm-hmm. Everything possible to like delay. And now we're just starting to be like, okay, let's start to move and cash in on this, mm-hmm. you know, and make it work now. Mm-hmm. Like a real business that makes exactly. money. You know what I mean? Like, and like we've been setting foundation forever, and now that allows us to like we're like getting a lot of inbound stuff now, so it looks like it's good, but that's like really that turning point.
Got it.
Like that's so it's right now.
Yeah,
pretty much. I mean, because you know, it's like when you it looks like an overnight success type of thing, sure, but there's years behind it, and absolutely. I'm at that like turning point.
Yeah and I think it's just so important to in your like, you know, the age that you are now, like those kind of early 20s, late teens, just keeping the overheads as low as you can.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people forget that because they want to prove the success as early as possible.
Right. And it's such a waste of time.
Yeah. If you can just like, you will thank yourself when you're 30, 35.
No one cares if you have a house at 24.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. You know, like, it's so true.
Especially in New York.
Yeah, exactly. And the same with me. I live in this tiny box apartment right now. Yeah.
You know, I think maybe what I love most about New York is mm-hmm. no one cares
that's
about
so true.
Where you live, your car.
Who you are.
You have a car? What?
Yeah. Why would none you have
of
a
that.
Car?
You know what I mean? Like none of that. Mm-hmm. Like as opposed to Los Angeles, for example, you know, like,
yeah, I agree.
Like it's just so obnoxious.
So less pretentious here.
And it's just all about it's like also like not even about money in a way. No. In New York, they don't even care about that.
No.
It's like, what are you doing for the world?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know? Are you an interesting person? Have you, you know, what value can you bring? And you know.
Yeah. And also like for me, especially like I was born in New York, so yeah. I'm like desensitized. I mean, to that's a lot great. Of
there's not many people that I meet who are born in New York. That's like a right. crazy thing.
I realized that mm-hmm. not until of course I went to, you know, elementary school, middle school, high school, college, everyone's born in New York. But once I leave, they're like, what, you were born here?
I'm
is that weird? Oh, you guys are all from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Okay. But because of that, like I'm like desensitized, like I'm literally desensitized to like meeting a billionaire.
Yeah.
It's weird. I'm like desensitized to being in an apartment that's $30 million.
It's so
a house
true.
That's $50 so million. True. It's like, it's like sick in a weird way. You know what I mean? Like, but on the other side, it allows you to have like a very level head. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's and clearly, you know, New York is like the most difficult place to live in the world. Maybe,
absolutely.
You know, like if you make it here, you make it anywhere. Like it's really true.
And I know? Think, I think what that does as well is that it removes any, like constantly comparing yourself. So when you live if you were to stay in your small hometown where you're from, you know exactly how much your neighbor's house is across the road, and you want to get a better car than them. When you live in New York and you have no idea where anyone made their money from, or where it's, or whether it's real or whether it's bullshit, you begin to focus on yourself and you begin to focus on what your goals are, and you don't constantly compare with your, you know, your friends or people you know. And I just mm-hmm. think you're right. It's such an amazing place to be.
And it's really just like, in a weird way, it's like, what is it called when you like pain? I forget what you call it, but it's like that. It's like you learn to love the pain.
Yeah,
I know what you mean. You know, yeah. And you like it because it's growth.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? And it's like, I can always relax and chill and have some average life.
Exactly.
Or not. I mean, I could honestly relax and have an above average life.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like any time I could tap out, you know mm-hmm, what I mean? And and that's good. That's good.
It's good to have that.
I have that because, you know, I realize my talent and connections and and value, you know, but like that's, I don't want to live like that. You know, it's like, why live if you're not going to like try to be great?
You know, I understand that. Yeah.
I just can't understand it.
I think a lot of people don't. It's sometimes difficult to be presented with that mindset.
It's oppression.
The school system doesn't teach that.
Yeah.
It doesn't teach that at all. You need to, you need to meet the right people and be exposed to the right message, which is difficult. Yeah. I think and New York is a great place for that to happen.
Yeah. But, you know, that's the other thing. Like, when you're, you know, when you're being an entrepreneur or doing like what you did, which is basically being an entrepreneur, even though you're at a company, right? Like you need that support system. It's just the only way you're going to not 100%. Kill yourself, you know, or get really depressed. Like you need to have other people around you because everyone else just doesn't get it.
Yeah. So true.
Like we're talking 99.999% of the world. Definitely. This has no idea.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we'll never, you know, we'll never start a business. We'll never raise money.
No.
Like just the fact that I've started a business and raised over $100,000. Mm-hmm. It's like crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the global scale.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
In New York, it's like,
yeah, it's so
you
true.
You know, but that's good because like I'm not like the goal isn't to raise money.
No.
The goal is to, you know, the goal is to like make something
your goals
you know, for the world. So
shift along with the people you surround yourself with.
Yeah. But I feel like I feel like it's a, you know, I'm even tempered in general. And when bad things happen, it's just I don't know, man. I just deal with it. I don't know what to say. It's like, what am I going to do?
It's a great opportunity.
What am I going to do? Just shrivel up and die?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
It's like, I put this pain on myself. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I can deal with it. And then, but I'm like really excited for what we're about to do.
Yeah.
And it's already starting to happen and we just got to kind of put the last piece in place.
Sure.
And we, you know, so that's what, you know, gets you through it.
Yeah, exactly.
But then, you know, I think once I'm, Once this whole thing, this whole cycle of me being in tech and whatever, you know, no business lasts forever, right? So like, you know, whatever, in 5-10 years when I'm out of this, maybe I'll make some life change and do something else. Because there's a lot of stuff I'm interested in. But
yeah.
I mean, right now, I feel like a really deep connection to the people we're going to help.
That's great.
So that's great. But, you know, I I'm sure you're interested in other stuff besides social media too. And sometimes you wish like, this Instagram thing, like, why can't I just do something like else, farming or
skiing,
science or something. You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah. So like, I mean, there's other, you know, I'm interested in like finance and real estate and science and, you know, space tech.
Yes.
There's a lot of stuff. And I believe that like, you're always taught that like, you gotta have, it's weird. It's like, they teach you like, you have to have like one career goal. Like, I want to be a firefighter.
It's crazy.
Right. And like, that's all you're going to do your whole life. Mm-hmm. I just don't believe that.
Yeah.
I really think like I can do everything I want to do eventually.
Eventually.
If I'm willing to work until 80 years old.
Cause it's time.
Come on. Yeah. It's a lot of time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that's what's going to happen, but yeah. Most difficult part is now though.
Yeah. That's good.
But, you know, this isn't that bad. We're sitting here like office at Times Square for like perspective. Like, look at us complaining. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
I know.
People would kill to be in my position. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you got to keep it in perspective helps. Too.
That's true.
Yeah. All right. Well, so where can people find you if they want to chat with you or inspired by your story?
A few places. I mean, you can email.
Apply to work at Social Chain.
I mean, you can email me, cahal@socialchain.com. That's CAHAL at socialchain.com. Or Instagram, at cahalb, CATHALB. And at Twitter, which is at cahaluk, CATHALUK.
Cool.
And yeah, that's if you want to reach out, do it.
Thanks. That's it.
Thank you.
Hey everybody, it's Chris again. Thank you so much for listening to the entire episode this week. If you made it this far, trust me, it's time to hit that subscribe button. I drop these every week, usually Friday and Monday, on iTunes podcasts, as well as Spotify. And also, if you want to leave me any feedback or get in touch with me, hit me up on Twitter or Instagram at ChrisHallNYC. If you want to email me, my email is chris@kickstarter.com. And all these as well are in the show notes and the description on YouTube. From my studio in Times Square in New York City to wherever you are listening to this in the world, thanks so much for listening. Have a great rest of your day, and I'll see you on the next episode of Beyond.